left me here to sing this song. Van Zeta docked in 1908, slept along the dirty street.
The music during the transition this time was Woody Guthrie singing Two Good Men about the Italian anarchists Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti, who were put on trial today in 1920 in Boston, and we celebrate them. Many people think they were innocent completely, so we are playing that today as we do our musical breaks. We are here now with our four guests. Remind you, on the way there, I want you to join me, by the way, tomorrow night, Thursday night, at Red Emma's. At 7:30 for a conversation, I'll be hosting Eddie Conway. Is now a free man. Black Panther was in jail for 44 years. He will be talking about his work with youth, both inside and outside prison, what jail was like, his analysis of all that. It's also a fundraiser for Eddie to pay legal fees and more, and he'll be there to sign his books. We'll be there at 7:30, taking your questions from the floor as well. We'll be taping the conversation for later airing here on the Mark Steiner Show. So that's at Red Emma's Thursday at 7:30 at 30 West North Avenue. You can go to redemmas.org for more information, but join us there. We look forward to having you there as we tape this conversation with Eddie Conway at Red Emma's. We are here now, continuing our studio. E.R. Shipp is with us, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, journalist in residence, and associate professor of journalism here at Morgan State University at the School of Global Journalism. Adar Ayira is back with us, project manager of More in the Middle Initiative at Associated Black Charities, facilitator and analyst at Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a program of fusion partnerships, and a spoken word artist. Bob Sorenby joins us, the editor of Daily Howler, and many, many years ago was a school teacher as well, significant in that he thinks about it and writes about education a lot. Daniel Denver joins us, a reporter for the Philadelphia City Paper, contributor to The Guardian, Salon, The New Republic. He wrote an article that I found really fascinating, chock full of fact, called The Resegregation of America's Schools for Al Jazeera America. And all of you, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. Your thoughts on Brown v. Board's 60th anniversary. But really, we're talking about what is happening now with America's schools, with Brown v. Board, in retrospect. And also, we'll be looking at how the press covered it then and how we might be covering things today. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Daniel Denver, let me begin with you. And if you talk about the piece that you wrote, the resegregation of America's schools, which I was really kind of looked at how what has happened to our kids, especially in the South, but across this country, and how the Supreme Court has weakened in decisions since Brown v. Board, integrating our schools, and even question the whole question of a right to education, which is not a right in America. Daniel?
Well, thanks very much. Yeah, it was 60 years ago that the Supreme Court ruled in Brown versus Board that segregation is unconstitutional. But what that ruling did was abolish the sort of explicitly mandated segregation that was made infamous in the Deep South. But what we have today in cities like Philadelphia, we have tons of schools that are nearly entirely black, miles from schools that are overwhelmingly white. The schools that are overwhelmingly black receive, in some cases, about half the funding per pupil as the more affluent schools a few miles across the city line that are entirely white, not entirely white, but nearly entirely white. Racial and economic segregation are still the core organizational features of American public education.
And I think that's part of the key, and we talk about the resegregation of public schools and what that means and its importance and the issues around that. But let me take a quick diversion here, because I just want to ask Shipp a question, then I'm coming right back to Ayar and to Adar to get her thoughts and then to Bob. But take us back for a moment, 60 years. Ship, if you would, not that you were necessarily
I was going to say, really?
You weren't there covering it, I know.
You were there.
I was a little boy, but I was there. I was a little boy, and I do remember the integration of Baltimore City Public Schools very well as a little kid in elementary school when that happened, and what happened in South Baltimore with the riots of white parents coming out to stop black kids from coming to Southern High School. I remember that very clearly and very well as a little boy. I think it was 10. Mm. Something like that. But tell us about...
Well, I remember... I don't remember. I really like to reflect on how the black press was covering the issue back then. We think about what happened in 1954 with the court's ruling, but there have been a lot of things going on in the years leading up to that, starting with this campaign launched by Thurgood Marshall and other lawyers involved with the NAACP. They were looking for the perfect cases to raise slightly different issues to catch the eye of the Supreme Court and hopefully force the Supreme Court to overturn the 1896 decision that made it okay for separate and equal to be the policy. Well, Black America was waiting to see what the court would do, but at the same time, they were a little bit wary. They weren't sure they could trust that what the court said would actually happen. So the Black press was constantly writing about what was going on and sort of stoking the excitement factor among Black folks. The day of the arguments before the court in 1952, 200 or 300 Black people lined up outside the courtroom trying to get seats so they could hear these arguments for themselves. And every week thereafter, there were questions being raised about when will this decision come down. It took another round of arguments even before the court finally was ready to rule as it did in May of 54. And throughout Black America, people were celebrating, but they were also hearing at the same time that in the South, governors and attorneys general were saying they were going to resist. And councils, the white citizens' councils, were being formed to be the daytime version of the nighttime Ku Klux Klan. And so they realized there was going to be a lot of resistance. So they were grateful for this decision, but knew that they had to be on their P's and Q's because nothing was going to really change overnight.
And didn't.
It did not.
And didn't. And so I'm curious what we think about where we've come to since that point, Adaria, that we look at schools around the country. That, you know, you look at certain states, I picked out three here, and we can pick up Maryland as well, which has a huge issue with resegregated schools. New York, California, Texas, 90% of the kids of color are in schools that are 51% Black or more. Mm-hmm. Or 51% of Black students are in schools that are 90% Black, I should say. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the importance of that issue and what that means.
Mark, so many issues, so little time. but, I'm so glad to hear you, Shep, talk and put this into context, because when you're talking about the resistance that was seen 60 years ago, there's a different resistance that we've seen in the 60 years since, and that is the resegregation in terms of parents, white parents, taking their students out of public schools, sending their students to private schools or charter schools, which makes it easier for a disinvestment in public schools. And what we've seen is that in states, particularly those states where you have a growing population of youth of color and an older population of whites, you've seen that the public support that schools and other public institutions where those youths are availing themselves have been given has been going down less and less. This has happened in Arizona. It's happened in California. It's happened in other states where the majority of youth are now people of color. So we see this. There's another issue, Mark, that has not been put on a table yet, but I would love to put it on a table, that in Maryland, we see that 76.4% of Maryland teachers are white and that 58.2% of students are not. Now, when you juxtaposition that with the report released by the Justice or Eric Holder's department that talks about suspensions and expulsions, over suspension, over expulsion of youth of color, the question becomes, how are teachers being readied to teach in school systems that are majority of color? How are they being ready to understand the experiences and the backgrounds of those students? And to what metric or what measurements are we going to hold teachers, hold those teacher prep programs in readying teachers to teach in those communities? Because this is also an issue about teacher stability. And we know that in under-resourced communities, most of them of color, you have the newer teachers and you have teachers who are more experienced opting out or being assigned to other communities. And that affects our children.
So there are a lot of issues here. that have come on the heels of thinking about where we are 60 years hence. And I know that before I bring up the issues, and I'll hear what Baum's comments are from the stuff you've been working on the Daily Howler.
Well, I'm most interested in the question that was just raised, how are we going to ready teachers to teach in our schools? Because when you simply look at the way society, look at enrollment figures for our school systems, we're not going to have a kind of a perfect world where every school is 50% white and 25%, we're not going to have racially balanced schools at any time. Just look at the enrollment figures. Prince George's County, 82,000 black kids, 6,000 white kids. Prince George's County is not going to produce magically racially balanced schools. The question is, but there's going to be 86,000 kids going to school tomorrow and going to school next September. How do we serve them? How do we give them a good experience in school, and how do we give them a productive experience? Because that's going to go on. And there's a certain kind, to me, there's a certain kind of Ozzie and Harrietism going on right now with the revisiting of Brown, where we're trying to picture a world where we have these magically racially balanced schools, which I'd like to see. My great niece, who's 7, goes to a racially balanced public school 3 blocks from her house in Durham. I'd love to see kids go to those schools. That's not going to happen. But those kids are going to be going to schools, and the question is, what do we do for them when they get there? How do we serve kids who are not going to be going to perfectly balanced schools? This is not going to happen.
I think go ahead, Adar, then I'll go back to
okay,
our
so guests. So that includes teacher readiness, and
yes,
that also includes
yes,
resourcing of
yes,
schools.
Absolutely.
You cannot treat every school the same because the circumstances and situations in those schools are not.
Absolutely.
So Daniel, you were about to say what?
Well, I agree that we can never have perfectly statistically racially balanced schools, but I think that we can go a lot farther than where we're at today. And looking at some place like PG County, I think really highlights the fact that it's a matter of housing segregation that underpins the segregation of schools. And we do see a lot more attention from civil rights groups and from the Obama administration more recently, focusing on breaking down those barriers that more affluent, disproportionately white communities raise against the construction of affordable housing. That's an important step, I think, in terms of moving to desegregate schools. I do think, of course, as well, that we can't leave within the segregated system that we unfortunately currently have. We have to deal with kids who are going into those schools tomorrow or in September, and that means we need funding equity immediately. And that equity means not only dollar for dollar, it means that students who are most in need actually need $1.50, $2 to the more affluent student's dollar. So I think that's a good starting place, for the short term. But in the long term, I do think that much more integrated schools and much more integrated neighborhoods are necessary.
It was interesting. We had a show, I guess this might be 6 months ago, 5 months ago, and we had people on who were teachers from the Prince George's County school system. There's another struggle going on inside of Prince George's County, where middle-class black neighborhoods do not want poor working-class black kids to be in their schools. They don't want them zoned in to their schools, which are where their kids go, the sons of government bureaucrats, physicians, lawyers, small business people. They don't want their kids going to school with kids from the projects. I mean, that's also...
And urban school systems have not been formed just by white flight, but also by black middle-class flight. I mean, that's been a big part of the way our demographics have changed, evolved over the last 50 years, too.
So when you look at that and couple that with this kind of, as you wrote about, Daniel, the kind of self-described, you put it, a self-described reform movement that looks at charter schools and evaluating teacher effectiveness by test scores that kind of dominates our public education debate right now, as you're talking about. I mean, that's part of this as well, because I think what Brown needs, looking at Brown v. Board 50 years, 60 years hence, needs to think about where we are now with public education and where we're going. That's really the question, because the whole question whether there's a right to education or not, which there is not. You know, there's no right to vote, and there's no right to education in our Constitution. Let's remember that. I mean, so where should we, how should we be in this conversation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the education reform movement, while it is brought up a lot of important issues, has sort of moved the conversation away from these core issues of equity and integration and focused on teachers' unions as the primary obstacle to educating poor children has concentrated on public management as the primary obstacle to educating poor children. Well, that really begs the question as to why teachers' unions and public management aren't a problem in more affluent suburban districts. And I think that that shifting of the conversation 60 years after Brown is a really good opportunity to reflect on what are the key issues of equity that we should be looking at in public schools.
We have about 30 seconds. I know, Adara, I'll let you jump right back in as soon as we come back from this break and go around the room and to respond to what Daniel was saying. Well, we are. We'll go to the phones at 410-319-8888. Bruce is on the line. We'll hear what he has to say. 410-319-8888 is the number here. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. You can also tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. I'm going to go out to break with Sir Duke by Stevie Wonder, which hit number one today in 1977. And Sir Duke was his homage to who? Duke Ellington. We'll be right back.
Music is a world within itself, with a language we all understand. With an equal opportunity for all to sing.
Tin soldiers and Nixon coming. We're finally on our own. This summer,
Ohio, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. It was released on this day in 1970, 2 weeks after the killings of Kent State. And let me say also, it was almost at the same time the killings took place at Jackson State that the song was released. And you're listening here to the Mark Steiner Show. Reminding you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's Credit Union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's Credit Union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. And we are here with E.R. Schiff, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, journalist in residence here at the School of Global Journalism at Morgan State University. Adara Ayira, who is project manager with More in the Middle Initiative at Associated Black Charities, facilitator and analyst of Baltimore Racial Justice Action, which is a program of fusion partnerships, a spoken word artist, Bob Summerby, editor of the Daily Howler, Daniel Denver, who is reporter of the Philadelphia City Paper, writes for The Guardian, Salon, New Republic, and more, and wrote the piece, The Resegregation of America's Schools, for Al Jazeera America. 410-319-8888 is the number here. When you come to the phones, Adara, you have something to say, then we'll go to the phones.
You know, I do agree that one of the points is about equity, but more specifically, it's about investment equity. Why do African-American middle-class parents not want those people in their children's schools, as you said before the break?
Right.
It is because everybody is afraid that students coming from under-resourced schools to their more resource schools will drive down test scores. We can resolve that issue by investing in those schools in under-resourced communities, in making sure that all children have the same quality of education regardless of the income level or the class of their parents. We don't do that now. And I just want to remind everybody that the whole issue around Brown versus Board of Education 60 years ago was not so that white children and children of color could sit in the same classroom. It was so that there would be more equity in terms of schools being resourced, because it wasn't. It was not. It was separate, but it definitely was not equal.
You know, that reminds me that back in the 1930s, there was a meeting convened to discuss the strategy for approaching public schools in the country. And one group of those who gathered, this was leading black intellectuals and educators, lawyers. One group wanted to fight to improve the quality of the schools as they existed then. They were not interested so much in integration. But the group led by Marshall and NAACP wanted integration because they thought that was the only way to assure that there would be resources. And then there were people like Du Bois who said he really didn't care what the color of the skin was that was sitting next to his grandchildren. He wanted them to get a quality education. So I think we do kind of lose sight of the fact that ultimately they were talking about a quality education for children, no matter how many white kids were sitting next to them.
And integration was a strategy because they felt that without that, then America would not care.
They wouldn't bulge at all.
But here's the question. Do American schools know what to do with kids who come from low-income, low-literacy backgrounds? Now, I don't know why parents of Prince George's County think what they do, or I don't know what they think. But there are big gaps in our student population between kids from middle-class professional backgrounds and kids from low-income, low-literacy backgrounds, and kids who arrived in the country last week not speaking English from low-literacy backgrounds. There's gigantic gaps in America's student demographic, which don't exist in most other countries around the world, most other developed countries. And even if you equalize resources or make resources fair based on need, there's still a question. Do teachers, do faculties in low-income neighborhoods know what to do with kids on the first day of kindergarten, kids who may be years behind their middle-class peers? There's gigantic gaps in our student population, which are present by age three. And I see very little discussion of this. Our national press doesn't care about this. Our national press is inept about this. They don't care. They're not going to go there. And I rarely see this discussed. And we can equalize resources all we want. That doesn't mean those teachers are going to know what to do on the first day of kindergarten.
That is such a critical piece, I think. That I'll bring Adar and Daniel, come jump right in as well. I mean, I think that is, we're not talking about how to teach and what these kids have gone through. There was a study that came out last week that we've been talking about here for the last 21 years on this program. But a study came out, this whole thing called hood disease, which I think people have popularized in the press, which I think is a real kind of racist term, and I don't like it. But what it's saying basically is that children, and whether they be black or white or Latino or Native American, Mexican or Puerto Rican, whoever they are, that live in communities of deep poverty and violence, suffer from post-traumatic stress that affects their education, their ability to learn, and the need to have people to do counseling and other things to help keep these kids whole while they're coming through what they're coming through. And, I mean, none of this, as you're saying, I think, Bob, is being taken into account when we talk about what we need to do to help our children who come from the poorest parts of our country, who increasingly make up our public school system, how to teach.
It's a point of tremendous disinterest in our national discourse. And, by the way, we can't even tell the public the test scores by black kids and Hispanic kids are much better over the last 20 years. There's so much propaganda being thrown around about how nothing works, our schools are a wreck, it's all the teachers' fault. Test scores for all three of our major demographic groups have been going steadily up on the tests that are reliable, the NAEP tests. The public can't even be told that. I mean, we have the most pathetic discussion, and liberals and progressives have allowed this. We need to tell people the test scores are better for black kids and better for Hispanic kids, and that's our public school teachers doing that.
Mm-hmm. Adar, then we'll go to Daniel and back to Shipp, and then I will open the phones here.
You know, I 100% agree with you, Bob. I mean, this whole discussion about teacher readiness, about teacher recruitment, about teacher evaluation, we don't have those discussions. And in a lot of other professions, you can't go and be an associate in a law firm without proving your proficiency. You can't be a medical doctor without some type of training that really shows that you know what you're doing other than your book smarts or your course curriculum. In teaching, you can. And we need to change that. At Associated Black Charities, we're having those discussions about teacher readiness, about where we go from here, about what we do, with a whole lot of partners addressing this issue across the table. And one thing that has come out of those is just the fact that we don't talk about it, and we need to talk about it more.
Daniel, and then Chip.
Well, I think that improving teacher training and curriculum is critical, but I also think that some of that discussion presumes that we're going to continue teaching students in racially homogenous schools from living in neighborhoods of concentrated poverty, when research shows that moving kids into diverse schools with middle-class students does raise scores, does raise academic achievement, does support all kinds of other positive outcomes. So I think that with all the discussion that takes place in the United States about what's going on inside the classroom and inside particular schools, that what is really fortunate about having the 60th anniversary of Brown is that it's an opportunity to actually look at the larger systemic inequities.
Well, I think we have to ask ourselves to what extent we're really committed to this notion of a more integrated society. What does that actually mean? When people who have the means, whether they are black or liberal whites or what have you, have the means to choose the best schools for their children, they're opting out of these schools we're talking about. So somewhere we need to have this discussion. How committed are we? And what kinds of sacrifices are we willing to make in order to make that happen? I don't see people willing to make that tough decision.
Because people are worried, I think, and rightly so, about what kind of education their kids are receiving. You know, I mean, my daughter, is my youngest, is in a school that's 90% children of color, Mexican-American and African-American, and maybe 8 or 10% white, whatever that number is, I'm not sure. It's a small number. But she's there for one reason, because it has an IB program. And because there's a National Baccalaureate program, that's why she's in that high school, to be at that. You know, otherwise, would you want to put your child through a system where the kids are not being educated the way you want them to be educated? And segregation works inside the school. She said to me, "said you realize that at lunch, our table, this always happens, our table is the only table in the lunchroom where Mexican, black, and white kids sit together. Every other table in the lunchroom are black kids, white kids, Mexican kids. Nobody ever talks. And people think we're weird because we have a table that's mixed." So that's also the nature of our system, despite 60 years after Brown v. Board, of where we are in America.
Well, Brown didn't claim to have an answer to every problem, you know, and Brown just said you can't set up separate school systems and say, "I'm sorry, black kid, you can't go to the school next door to your house because it's not for you." Brown said you just can't do that, and that's not being done,
right.
You know. But Brown didn't pretend to have all the answers. There's reasons, by the way, why parents, whether they're white parents or black parents, avoid certain schools. We have some schools that are so dysfunctional, you wouldn't want anyone's children going to those schools. And the fact that children have to go to them is very, very unfortunate. And it's not shocking when white middle-class parents or black middle-class parents don't want their kids to go to certain schools, given these gigantic gaps.
I do have to get to the phone, but Adar, please go ahead.
The issue, Mark, is privilege. The issue is that there are some people who have it, some people who don't, so some people who can opt out of. And as long as we are committed, as long as we as a society say, if you have the privilege, you can go to this school, and it's just too bad for those children whose families do not have that privilege. As long as we're comfortable with that status quo, then we're going to get what we get. But I'll tell you this, in the 21st century, in this global economy, if we as a state, as a region, if we are not producing a workforce, if we're not producing leaders, if we're not producing people who can read and who can grow and who can increase the economic viability of this state, then we're going to lose businesses, we're going to lose families, we're going to lose everything. And it's not just going to be the people with privilege who are sustaining or who lose. It's going to be everybody. It's going to be all of us.
I wanted to disagree, saying that the statement that Brown v. Board only had to do with you can't not go to this school down the corner from your house. It said that the segregation of white and Negro children in the public schools of a state solely on the basis of race, pursuant to state laws permitting or requiring such segregation. It emphasized that state laws permitting such segregation were also illegal. But what we saw in latter Supreme Court decisions was a walking back of that more radical principle to the idea that only extremely overt racial segregation was unconstitutional. But I would make the case that Brown actually had a much broader vision of striking down segregation.
What was that broader vision then?
I think the broader vision was that any sort of state laws permitting segregation, which very much include the sorts of residential patterns of segregation that were fueled by racist government mortgage subsidies, redlining, all sorts of explicitly methods to segregate the American metropolis.
I've been neglectful of the phones. Me, open the phones here. 410-319-8888. Bruce, you're on the air.
Yeah, so I'm listening. Unfortunately, I misplaced it a couple days ago. I love to read Wesley Pruden of the Washington Times. Even if you don't agree with what he says, he's so colorful. He expresses it so well and with such humor and irony. So he tackles the so-called resegregation of the city schools and the school systems, and he explains how it is, listen carefully, nonsense. First of all, people live where they want to live. And in some cases, obviously, they're probably in municipal areas, there's probably higher concentrations of people of color. And there could be in suburbs or in other areas, higher concentrations of white people. But it doesn't mean it's any type of segregation. People move to different places for different reasons. I live in a city. I like to move out of the city just because the city services stink. And so let's put it another way. Here's also part of the other problem. Maybe there is a good chance that some of the municipal school systems aren't run real well, and maybe it's because they don't have the funding that some of the surrounding counties. I don't know anything about Prince George's County, but I know something about Ballmer City and Ballmer County, some of the other surrounding counties. One of the reasons why generally the schools outperform in some of the county areas is because they also have a better tax base and better funding. And maybe to a certain extent, maybe the city isn't, it doesn't, the city, what's going on in Board of Education and the people that run the cities don't do a real well job too. So this resegregation stuff is nonsense. It's racial dogma. I get tired of the nonsense.
Okay, thanks. Let me tell you, Bruce, why I think you may be wrong about this, because that segregation in housing has a lot to do with segregation of schools. And people, I mean, it's been shown over and over again, are discriminated in housing, in whether it's apartments or buying a home. That's been a pattern that's been studied, that has been shown, verified. It's nothing that people are just pulling out of the hat going, oh, this is why there's segregation. That is why it does exist, because people are steered away from neighborhoods. And these things that have been going on ship for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the conventional wisdom that people just live where they want to live. But first of all, studies show that Black Americans want to live in integrated neighborhoods at much higher rates than white Americans want. And then the historical record is very clear about the government and private interests that segregated Black people from white people and created the segregated reality that we have today.
Ship?
No, I agree with that. Of course, you'll find some exceptions to that. I recently heard from a Black person who said he never wants to be around white people. But I don't think that's the norm. And we do know for sure that there are many obstacles to where people live, where they can find work, and those things ultimately impact who goes to which schools.
So let me ask a question of the four of you here as we're here. A little time we have left, and this woman named Tiffany is calling in. We'll get to her call right now. But how important is it for schools to be racially and economically integrated?
Well, we know from experience, I think, that you'll find the resources where you have a more integrated, diverse population of children. You'll have a different set of parents who will be active in advocating for their children. You'll have the children learning from each other in ways that will benefit them going forward. So we can see that it's important for a number of reasons. But we have to understand that if they are not perfectly integrated, we still have an obligation to provide good educations.
And they're not going to be perfectly integrated. And then when you get the perfectly integrated school and the parents will come in and get the gifted and talented program, then you end up with the seating arrangements, which you just described. So, you know, the thing I always come back to, we have to learn how to serve kids from low literacy backgrounds. It doesn't matter whether they're in schools with each other, whether they're in schools with perfect racial balance. There's always going to be types of separation going on. The question always is, do we know how to serve the kids who are coming in behind their middle-class peers? Do we know how to serve them? I'd say right now the answer is no. No, we don't. And there's very little discussion of it.
Every child deserves a quality education, and the resources should not be color-coded, and resources should not be only available to those who are privileged.
410-319-8888. Tiffany, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to share that this really hit home for me just listening to the topic. I was fortunate enough growing up that my family, you know, we were like the only two black, families that lived in a suburban area. I was able to go to a good school. And I felt, for me, I'm a middle class person, and I wanted to raise my child in the same way and send her to, and right now she's going to a private school. And just wanted to keep her, where she's going to get the best education. But I never really thought of, the topic, as you put it, that, if people like me aren't investing in the local schools, things aren't going to get better. So it's not just about, you have a better situation, so send them somewhere else. It's about us. You know, I'm always talking about I want to support my community, but I might need to do it in a way where, maybe I do send my child there, and maybe I get involved and help make that change. And I certainly agree that, yes, the teachers may need better training, but it's also going to come from parents like myself who do have that opportunity, getting involved, investing, and helping out as well. So I'm really, really glad that you guys opened up my eyes today with this topic. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tiffany, so much. And I think we need to go on with this conversation. It's an important one to have. There's a report out about Baltimore Opportunity Schools that I'd like to wrestle with. I've not read, but I have, that Jay's Motel sent about. They looked at schools that are working in high poverty areas and why they're working, and why aren't we talking about why they're working and others are not, what's going on inside those schools between teachers and training and teachers doing what the principals are doing. And I think that's important to look at.
Absolutely.
And we're going to have that conversation, invite some of these guests back to have that conversation. I'm going to go through the report over the weekend. I got it last week. I haven't had a chance to look at it yet, but I'm really going to pour through it and then bring that conversation to the air, because I think we need to figure this out. I think this is not it's not rocket science. And I said to somebody the other day, I'll just leave this thought, that, when we talk about kids coming to the third grade not having a certain vocabulary, and I think and that then they can't, that people say they can't achieve after that. Well, I don't believe that. I think it's how we teach our kids. And I think over and over again about the books the authors I've been interviewing about slavery in America, slavery being the underpinning of the capitalist society that we have. But part of those conversations, all those books, have been about people who walked out of slavery absolutely illiterate, and ending up in masses, reading and writing, studying Greek and Latin, studying mathematics, writing books, and leading communities. So I think we have to throw all those things out the window that we think can't be done, and think about what can be done, and how do we do it? How do we train people? And talk about why we're not doing it and what these schools are doing. So we got like 10 seconds.
Maybe also looking at the lessons of schools that when the school system was segregated, teachers who believed in their students, their African-American students, not those students not being shackled by the low expectations or the stereotypes of their teachers.
And I have so much to say about that as well, but we can't do it next. We got to roll. But Adora, you're always good to have you here.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Bob Swinby, thank you for bringing the conversation. We just brought Ship, always a joy, pleasure to have you, and bringing your thoughts to this show. Daniel Denver, great to meet you, and thank you for coming. I hope you'll come back again as a guest.
Thanks. This is such a great station.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you being with us today.